everyone, and welcome to episode 17 of season 9 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the last two Die Hard movies, Die Hard 4.0 and A Good Day to Die Hard, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane, the composer and conductor of so many Movies by Minute group project. Not including the ones that he's done on his own. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Wow. Well, thank you again so much, Rob, for having me on the show. It's always it's always a pleasure to do these things, although I'm never sure what I'm going to be saying when I come on. So
isn't that part of the joy?
Well, joy is one way to put it. Anxiety, I think, is a better way. But yeah, no, I hopefully I can be a participant who can contribute. So.
Well, so far you've contributed very well over 9 seasons for me. So, you have an open invitation every season that I do. It's always fun.
I appreciate being part of it.
I always get interesting stories from you about taking a helicopter from Elizabeth to Newark to LaGuardia to Kennedy.
What's the Chinese saying of me? You live in interesting times. I feel like I've been living in interesting times most of my life.
Isn't that what makes life more enjoyable? That it's interesting. Who wants to be boring?
Exactly. Well, that's why we make podcasts. Yeah.
Exactly. So episode 17 begins with John and Farrell looking for Warlock, and ends with Warlock trying to explain things. So yesterday we ended things with John telling us and Farrell that he sort of learned how to fly a helicopter, and let's hope he's able to figure out where he needs to go from there. And the helicopter takes off and they start flying around, and John goes, "We're up," and Farrell is not happy. He goes, "Oh God. Okay, that's good. That's pretty good." And John just looks out and sees it's a very nice view what they let us see for him. John just sees that everything is completely dark. And he goes, "Jesus, look at that. The whole area is blacked out." Now, one of the things that I noticed, and you probably know the answer to this. Yeah, you have the red lights on top of tall buildings so that they don't get hit by the planes and helicopters and everything, keep their distance. Are those usually either battery operated or via a generator or something like that? Because in this shot you see them.
Yeah, and I mean typically they have a battery backup, and they are usually just very bright LEDs, so they don't use a lot of power. So they could probably run for days without significant degradation, and mm-hmm. you really don't want the light on top of your building to go out, especially if you live in a high traffic aircraft area.
Yeah, for sure. But that makes a lot of sense. And then John basically says, "How are we going to find Warlock's house?" And Farrell gives a great answer. He says, "It's probably going to be the one with the lights still on." It's a great response, which we'll get to in shortly when we actually find the house. But again, it makes you wonder how they actually shot this so that everything is blacked out. You think that's all CGI, that they just turned off all the lights?
I'm imagining, yeah. I mean, they probably just went in with a something like Adobe After Effects or Final Cut Pro or one of those things where you can just go in and paint out lights. So I think that's all they had to do. I don't think they had to ask everybody the next 30 miles to turn out their lights.
Right, exactly. We're filming. We need a 3-second shot of downtown Baltimore. Everyone just on the count of three, turn off your lights, and then so we can get the shot. I don't think so. And then we're back in the FBI building, and Molina is looking at a map on the screen, and he goes, power outage keeps spreading. About half the East Coast has already gone down. Now, did you look at the? I mean, it's great that they have a real time satellite picture where you see the lights go out on the screen in whole areas and stuff like that. Again, do you think that that's real? Do you think it's possible that they could have such a thing?
I mean, I would think that it's more of a like that would be a computer representation of what's out. You know, it's similar to, you know, you bring up Google Maps or something like that, and it shows you.
Google Maps shows you your house 5 years ago. You know, it doesn't show you what's going on right now.
Yeah, and this was 2007, so I don't know if I would think that it's some kind of a, I would think it's some kind of a computer representation rather than a camera. Although I don't know if the graphics were that good a decade and a half ago.
Right, but it also makes me wonder how come the entire western portion of the U.S. is not lit up?
Maybe this might only be showing the non-ERCOT and non-Western. The country is divided into Eastern District and Western District, and then except for Texas, which is called ERCOT. Which is they have their own grid, but I think this might only be showing one grid. Although why they're showing the West since they're not covering it, maybe it's just so that they could, maybe people don't know what the eastern half of the country looks like, and it would be confusing. So you're looking at, you know, look at all the USA, and this, we don't, we're only controlling the thing on the right hand side.
That's okay. It's possible. And then Bowman says, "All right, put everything on emergency generators." He goes, "How the hell are they getting past us?" You know, I love how in movies everyone thinks that they are the smartest guy in the room. That there can't be anyone smarter. It doesn't matter. Even you know, a rogue you know, former agent.
Yeah. Who knew all the codes and all the whole layout of the place, but
how are they getting past us? How are they doing this? You know, but they also do know that you know, you had all these hackers, so apparently someone was able to figure out how to do it. That's more or less what it comes down to. And then we're back in the helicopter, you know, looking down at a very dark Baltimore, and you know, you see cars that are still driving around there, so that works too. And then Farrell says, "All right, down there, I see it." And John goes, "Down there?" And he goes, left, down. "We're going to land there. We're going to land down there. All right, hang on." Okay. And, you know, then we get to see how John's lessons were about, you know.
Yeah, in amongst buildings and wires and,
He should be very glad that he didn't, you know, electrocute them somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
you know, and as he's landing, he goes, "All right, hang on." And he goes, fence, I see, what?" And then they just crash through the fence.
A mighty strong tail rotor, too. It's cutting through the metal when it's been turned into splinters in the real world.
That's right. And they don't even show us that the helicopter's not damaged. You know, the helicopter, maybe it's made out of vibranium.
Yeah, that could be it. Or adamantium, who knows?
Yeah, one of the two.
Yeah.
And then Farrell looks at him and goes, "All right, yeah, taking off is the hardest part."
Yeah, landing, you just let gravity take its course.
That's right. John's not surprised at all. He doesn't care. He goes, "Let's go." And then they start walking over towards the house that has some lights on.
Yeah.
And, you know, Farrell says, "Now, there's something you need to know about Warlock. He hates cops. I mean, he hates them. Okay? So just let me do all the talking."
And they've got, really antique, in that backyard, they have super antique metal galvanized or anodized garbage cans from, they look like something out of the 40s, but I guess this is just trying to show that it's a bleak urban landscape.
Well, what it's also showing is that Warlock likes to use older things.
Yeah.
He likes to be off the grid somehow. So apparently, if you're still using the garbage, the trash cans from the 1940s, it works.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of that stain on the window of the back door? Is that a decal of an American flag that got ripped off, or did somebody hit a bloody hand up on the window? I just can't figure out.
I would think it's possibly a decal that was taken off. That's what I would think. It does not look like it doesn't look like a blood. It like it's blood.
Yeah.
And then as they're walking through, John just goes and just looking around everything. And then Farrell knocks on the door and. A woman comes to the door and opens it without even asking who it is. I mean, again, it's very they're in the middle of a blackout and someone knocks on your door and you just open the door. So hey, why not? It can't be anything bad, right?
Yeah, especially if they're covered in like gas refinery or a gas generator blow up on them.
Oh, come
And
on.
the one guy out there has a bandage that's covered in blood all across his elbow.
That's right. Now, do you know who this actress is who plays Freddy's mom?
That I do not.
Okay, so her name is Rosemary Knower, Knower. She was born in 1942, passed away in 2019. She had 24 credits as an actress. She was in the one of the latest versions of Friday the 13th, the one that came out in 2009. She had a small part in this movie. She was in Hairspray. She was in Serial Mom. She
Wow,
played.
so she's Baltimore centric.
She was on an episode of The Wire. So that tells you also
Wow.
something about that.
Maryland's own.
Apparently, she was born in Baltimore and she passed away in Wynnewood, Pennsylvania, of a stroke. First of all, I love that you can see the pictures behind her. They're all like black and white pictures of
Yeah.
you see, one of them looks like a wedding. One of them looks like a picture possibly of Warlock as a kid. I don't know. But I love the other. Picture frame that's right behind her, which is something that they used to do, and they don't have them. They don't really do them anymore. Where you have like I don't know, 10 or 15 pictures in the same frame, and it's
Yeah.
all like cut out with different shapes and sizes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I do it yourself collage.
I mean, in my mother's house, she still has things that pictures from the 70s and 80s that she had those. Type of collages, so I'm very familiar with it, and but it's nice to
Yeah.
see that they went into the detail to make sure they had something like this here, because it sort of fits in with this character.
Yeah, the whole and the region, it seems like a very Baltimore thing that you'd have on your wall.
Yeah, makes sense. And then Farrell says, "Hello, Mrs. Kalutis. Is Freddie home? I'm Matt Farrell, and this is Billy. We're friends from space camp. We went to space camp with Freddy." So, first of all, let's start with, have you ever heard the name Kalutis before?
No, that was a new one on me.
Okay, so it is a name that has Greek origins, and it's probably derived from a village in the mountains of western Greece called Kaludi, Aitola Karnanias, something like that. I
Wow.
apologize for any Greek speakers who actually know what I should be saying there. But it possibly it means beautiful or good, noble, things like that. Globally, It is the 2,661,929th most frequent last name. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. So she gets a lot of, can you spell that, please? Because
right,
it's not
right.
like a.
And it is apparently globally 1 out of 137,500,866 people has this last name. Yeah. So.
So if you bump into a Kaloudis, consider yourself lucky because it's a rarity.
Exactly. I mean, according to this website that I found, there are 32 people that have that last name.
And they'll be joining us on the show in a little what?
Yeah.
Say
but what's very interesting here is it says that it is primarily the name is primarily concentrated in Maryland.
Oh, okay. So it's a familiar name.
Yeah. So yeah, Maryland, Wisconsin, Illinois. But mostly in Maryland. So it makes me wonder, you know, if you know, someone on the production knows that this is a predominantly Marylandian name. I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah.
But
I would imagine that the Kaloudis family were at the premiere in Baltimore high-fiving each other when they heard their name mentioned.
That's right.
It doesn't come up in conversation very often.
Probably not. But again, I like the little attention to detail about that.
Yeah.
Because you know? Like if it would have said, yeah, it's predominantly a name in South Dakota, I'd be like, okay, I don't know. But here
they did their homework.
Right. They definitely did. And I liked it. Okay. So they mentioned the name Fred. So we've already talked about you know, the name Fred, Alfred, and stuff like that. But I found a whole bunch of anagrams that for systems that are named Fred. So you have a Federal Reserve Economic Data, which is a database maintained by the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis, which sort of is connected to this movie. It is the nickname for a Lockheed C-5 Galaxy aircraft.
Oh.
It is the device at the end of a train, the flashing rear.
Oh yeah, the Fred, the red, yeah, the red something.
Rear end device.
Rear end device, yes. It replaced the caboose.
Yes. You have field rations eating device. It's a army knife for spoon combination. You have the Forum for Renewable Energy Development that's in Scotland. That's named after that. But yeah, I just thought it was, again, the caboose thing was the thing that really jumped out at me. You know, the it's called End of Train Device.
Yes.
I love the name.
Yeah, I miss the cabooses. I think that kind of the early 90s cabooses got phased out, but that was always the thing to watch for.
Yeah. And then he mentioned Space Camp. So what can you tell me about Space Camp, Jim?
Well, one of my favorite people in the world, Homer Hickam, is he's on the advisory board for Space Camp. Space Camp's been around since the, I believe, the early 80s, and located in Huntsville, Alabama, home of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center Museum as well, and the Redstone Arsenal, which is also the Marshall Space Flight Center, where most propulsion experiments and development is done by NASA. Being attached to the edge of the Redstone Arsenal, they get a lot of interaction with scientists, engineers, and astronauts who come and visit to participate with students in different courses that they have there. Summer camp for kids, although it is a camp-like environment. It teaches about astronautics, aeronautics, navigation in space, and it ranges from youngsters. I believe the starting time is 10. But it goes into, there are even adult space camp activities you can go to.
Okay, excellent. I'm surprised if you couldn't get Homer to get you into one of the adult classes, you know, space camp. I'm sure you would be thrilled.
I, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure I could. I'm sure I could to get Homer to give me a to give me a good word with the folks at Space Camp. Unfortunately, with this our move from Texas to North Carolina has kind of precluded any activities other than me stacking boxes in rooms. So
Okay, but
maybe in the future.
Jim, we both know if you get a phone call today telling you that you're starting Space Camp tomorrow, okay,
Oh, I'll get my flight suit on. Don't worry. Yeah.
you're toast. And we both know that your wife will be happy to let you go, even if
Sure,
maybe
she'll be, yeah, she'll be give me the big okay sign or something like that. And say have a great time.
So, friend of the show and previous guest on numerous seasons, including this one, Lisa Leahy, who was just here a few weeks ago, she actually was at Space Camp because she was she a few years ago she won Teacher of the Year award for Rhode Island, and they let them go to Space Camp for a week. So she's had that experience, quite envious of the of that idea. You know, would have
It's a
been.
marvelous program. It really and there are a lot of current astronauts who started out in a space camp, so it's definitely it has an effect on young people and on adults too.
So, it was established in 1982. The original idea was thought of by Wernher von Braun in 1977 when he saw a group of students that were taking notes on everything that they were hearing about, the space program and stuff like that. And so he said, "Hey, why don't we do something for kids, to help them with their future?" So, Space Camp itself is a 6 day program that's mostly for children between the ages of 9 and 11. That's the original idea for Space Camp. It's a Sunday through Friday activity type of thing where children will learn study about space, aviation, robotics, things like that. Then they have the next group is called Space Academy, which is for 12 to 14 year olds. And it's also 6 day sessions. Then you have the Advanced Space Academy, which is designed for 15 to 18 year olds. And it was originally known as Space Academy Level 2, and they began that in 1987. And it actually became a college, they were able to get college credits for it through the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Then they started a program to allow families to go there. It was called the Family Camp, which allowed parents and guardians to also attend Space Camp with their child. And it's 3 or 4 days. And they also have in the summer, for families to show up there. And then the final one is the Advanced Space Academy Elite, which is actually offered to graduates of the previous Space Academy program.
They also have it's not as promoted as heavily, but they're besides astronautics, they also have a group called Aviation Challenge, which gets into more about aircraft and aircraft systems, avionics and things like that. Jared Isaacman, who's now currently the head of NASA, was a graduate of the Aviation Challenge Space Camp in Huntsville, and he's a great proponent of the space camp experience. So we're probably going to be hearing a lot more about that education-wise from NASA's new director.
For sure. And they also offer a 12-day Advanced Space Academy program that features multiple missions, scuba diving, use of some of the Aviation Challenge facilities, and a 24-hour extended duration mission. So, I mean,
Oh.
this is all very cool stuff that they have there. In addition, they had camps in other places that they had Space Camp Florida, which was stopped in 2015, which they had from 1988. It was in Titusville in Florida. Then after that, they also had one in Space Camp California, which ran from 1996 to 2002. But they ran out of finances, so they ended up closing that one. And I'm assuming you've seen the movie Space Camp also. So
yes. Yes, Leah Thompson's greatest triumph besides Back to the Future.
Yeah. That is true. Yeah, so Mrs. Kalutis believes the fact that that John and Farrell attended space camp with Freddie. But it tells you the fact that you know, Freddie actually was in space camp, because you know, whether Farrell really was in space camp or not, we don't know. But Freddie must have been, because his mother would have known this.
Yeah, so her son didn't accidentally wander off to Alabama for a week when he was nine.
Exactly. You know, she decides to eventually let them in, even though she seems a little skeptical, especially with John, you know, outside just bleeding. Doesn't look very not necessarily someone that I would have invited into my house so simply.
Yeah, at what time of night too? I don't think this is like, you know, 6 o'clock.
No, yeah, because it's the summer. This is,
yeah,
July 4th weekend, so you can't even.
That's
say
right. Yeah, so it's got to be maybe 10, 11 o'clock if it's this something. Dark.
Yeah. Well, it's dark because of the lights on and also, but.
Yeah.
And then she starts screaming, "Freddie, Freddie, you got company." And then the shot changes, and we get to see, I guess, Freddie's lair, which is really cool. You know, he's got the. You know, you see Boba Fett, you see Obi-Wan Kenobi with the lightsaber. And you see Kevin Smith, you know, in a chair, playing on a keyboard.
And I think, yeah, and there's, I just keep wondering, knowing Kevin Smith, I wonder how much of that
is real stuff.
Collectibles is his stuff. It could be his. There is a small product placement with Arby's. I noticed there's a little Arby's bucket that apparently he doesn't get out of his chair, but he does like his Arby's. So
well, we did talk about Arby's a few weeks ago also, because they, you know, because they passed an Arby's and then Farrell said that he's so hungry he'll eat the wrapper or a whole bunch of or ketchup packets.
Ah, there's also in the far background there's a Rockola. 45 jukebox in the deep distance.
Mm-hmm.
Behind
you can see it behind both.
Yeah, yeah, and the Battle for the Planet of the Apes. I think they call that a spectacular. It's a lobby banner that's over Kevin Smith's head.
Yeah,
and you can see one of the gorillas. But just a. It's enough to suggest that he collects a lot of things, but it's not really. In looking around, there aren't that many things that you need on. And like you were saying, maybe they weren't considering high definition TVs were going to be, you know, letting you look at all the individual things going on in the
exactly.
scene.
But some geek had a lot of fun setting up this room.
Oh yeah, the set designer must have been a complete nerd. And is that an Asteroids video game in the background there?
Yes.
Okay. Making big rocks into littler rocks. And there's a Gen 1 iPod.
Yes. Along with a whole bunch of music CDs we see on the side there. And like three books.
Who's the figurine behind Obi-Wan? I was trying to figure out who that was.
I couldn't figure that out. I was trying to figure it out. I have no idea.
I was thinking maybe it's a Ferengi or.
No, that isn't not, quite. It's not a Ferengi.
Yeah.
I don't know. It looks like maybe a werewolf or something like that because of the way that the hands.
Yeah, I thought it might have been Pinhead from.
No, it's not. It's not Pinhead.
Okay.
I wasn't able to figure out what that is. It's interesting. It looks very familiar. I just can't figure out what it is.
Yeah. Well, one of those better left a mystery.
Yeah. I'm assuming if we did a search on the internet, I'm sure somebody has made a a list of everything in
Oh
the
yeah. Yeah, there's an entire internet. One thing I noticed, the bathroom with the arched bricks, it reminds me of Silence of the Lambs, where I think Hannibal Lecter was kept in a prison in Maryland, but I may be mistaken. But it just had that Hannibal Lecter look to it, the arched way near the corner faucet. For some reason, they have a big, like a mop sink, and then they have a hand sink that's not being used by John McClane.
Right. I mean, you can go if you go online, you can find there's a place called propstore.com that has a list of memorabilia from basically well, it's showing all the Die Hard that I see here, not just the, oh my God, some of the stuff they have here. You can buy like a John McClane shirt, from Die Hard with a vengeance. Interesting.
I do have the only Die Hard memorabilia I have is I do have a Christmas ornament of a John McClane ventilator shaft where he's holding the Bic lighter out in front of him, and that's it's a picture at the end of a ventilator shaft that has been turned into a Christmas ornament. They're very popular online, so I think maybe a third of Pinterest ornaments are consist of John McClane nowadays.
Very possible. Don't know, but again, it's very interesting to try and figure out what he has in the room. But so anyone out there who knows who this character is, please let us know. I guess that's the closest we're going to be able to get to figuring that one out. And then. Then Mrs. Kaluta says to him, "Freddie, Frederick, didn't you hear me?" And he goes, "Oh, Baltimore heard you, Ma." He goes, "Your friends are here." He goes, "Friends? What? What the? Come on, Ma. How many times I gotta tell you? You don't bring people down here, man."
Do you know any of the story about how Kevin Smith wound up in this movie? I was wondering how he got cast. I hadn't heard anything.
No, I'm not familiar with how he got connected to it, but it sort of makes sense,
Yeah,
he
I
fits
mean
in
it's
perfectly in this in this in this role. I don't know, maybe he knows Les Wiseman. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very, it's intriguing having him being it's kind of like when worlds collide. Usually, he's on the outside looking in on a lot of these things, and here he is a part of it all. So.
There's nothing on IMDb that explains it. The only thing they told us is that he rewrote the dialogue for the scene, so that it fits him better, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I don't know the backstory of how he got cast here in this particular
Yeah. And this is almost 10, maybe even more than 10 years before his heart attack was in 2018. So this is a big Kevin Smith, not
Yes.
skinny Kevin Smith. So you can kind of place him by his size in any movie.
Yeah, that's true. And what's great is if you look at the, you can see that he's got this like huge screen for 2007. That's also, he's using his computer on a huge flat screen. Just going through everything there, trying to figure it all out. And then, as everyone comes into the room, John goes over to little faucet to go, I guess, wash himself off. It looks pretty dingy down here,
In doing further research on Kevin Smith being cast in Live Free or Die Hard, he had a friendship with Bruce Willis because Bruce Willis was in the Kevin Smith movie Jersey Girl, 2004, as an uncredited cameo. The bond grew through mutual respect and shared interests, with Willis appreciating Smith's humor and work in films like Clerks and Mallrats. When Live Free or Die Hard was in development, the director Len Wiseman and the production team were looking for someone to play Warlock, a quirky basement-dwelling hacker with a deep knowledge of tech and pop culture. Willis, knowing Smith's persona and his ability to develop and deliver sharp, witty dialogue, suggested him for the role. Smith's real-life enthusiasm for geek culture and tech made him a natural fit. So, Kevin Smith has shared in several interviews that Willis personally called him to offer the role, bypassing a traditional audition. Smith was a longtime diehard fan, and he was thrilled at the opportunity and be part of the iconic franchise. It was small but a memorable role. He filmed it over 3 days, with his performance tailored to suit his natural comedic style, with improv encouraged to enhance his eccentric personality. So, it pays to be good friends with Bruce Willis, I think, is
Apparently.
the lesson to be learned from here.
Yeah, that's what I would say. And when he gets up from his chair and turned around, so we see he's got a whole bunch of screens here. One of them has Gears of
Yes.
War on it, and then on the left-hand side, you can see that he's got a game of solitaire going.
It's a kind of a complicated solitaire too. I'm not sure which variation of it is, because there seems to be a row of cards along the bottom as well.
Yes. Now, do you know how many different variations of solitaire there are?
I would guess there's probably more than 10.
There are over 500 different variations.
I was right.
Yes.
More than 10. Hooray.
We're not going to count them. Don't worry. We won't go
No, okay.
one by
There,
one. I do
I know
remember.
Klondike, I think.
Yes, I like Klondike. I remember. I'm a fan of Yukon. Golf, 40 Thieves. I remember that back back in the early 90s when I first got a computer, so that you would get a packet of solitaire where you could play a whole bunch of different you had all different choices of all the different games and stuff like that. Do you know when they started well, first of all, do you know what the official name of solitaire is?
It's something like headache, or it's some kind of a painful condition, I think. I'm not sure.
No, it's patience. Patience.
Patience, that's what, I'm sorry, it's a virtue.
It is. That it is. And the games of patience and as cards goes all the way back to the late 1700s. And then it started becoming more popular in France in the early 19th century. And by the second half of the 19th century, it reached England and America, and the in Germany, the earliest known description of it is in a is is from 1783. There was a book of games that had it in there. It was called the Das Neue Königliche Lahambre Spiel. I don't know what that means. I don't know German, so I couldn't tell you. But it's a game that's been around for quite a long time. There are many different because there are many different variations, so there's many different ways of going through the game. Sometimes it's stacking cards based on the numbers, sometimes based on the suits, sometimes there's so many different ways to do it. I always used to like the games where which is like Free Cell, that you can always win. You just have to find the right pattern to win. That type of thing.
I remember on the, I think it was the Amiga computer, they had a solitaire game that you could have hints, and it would tell you what to do next. And I was thinking, if you need hints to play solitaire, you're probably playing the wrong version of solitaire.
Well, some of them are very complicated. There was one called Clock that I used to play. Again, it's been so long since I played solitaire. I couldn't even tell you how to play it. It just I remember that you set them up in a clock frame, and the idea is to eventually get the numbers 1 through 12 in the spots, in the right spots, and things like that.
I remember playing a version called Spider Solitaire, and it was done with it's a two deck version, and it's very challenging. I don't remember how to play it, but I just remember it was very it was a great time suck. It was just like, oh, I've been playing this for 45 minutes, I gotta stop. But yeah, it was
Exactly. It's one of the pro it's a problem.
yeah, and
How is it for you guys?
I think it was called Spider because it started building like webs. It would slowly move down.
And at this point, Farrell then moves towards the Warlock and says, "I can't see too good. Is that a young bearded Han Solo? What happened, man? You lost so much weight." Now, again, do you think this reference of him saying "I can't see too good" is a reference to Han Solo after he gets out of the carbonite?
Ooh, that could be. That's a possibility. And gosh, I mean, Kevin Smith is one of the people who it's believed had an effect on the Star Wars universe by of course, that he was complaining about subcontractors that were or contractors that were building the Death Star, and they were innocent roofers and things. And of course, with Geonosis in the episode two of Star Wars, we found out that basically they were killing a bunch of bugs, so it really didn't matter. You don't really like the bugs. They were it wasn't that big a moral difficulty.
That's right. And then Warlock responds, "No, dude, I gained 30 pounds." And he turns to John and goes, "Who is that?" He goes, "Oh, that. You know what? Doesn't matter. Dude, what are you even doing here? Because of you, I am rocking five generators just so I can stay online. And since you're being hunted by assassins, it doesn't really make me think like this visit is a very productive one or healthy use of my time." And I mean, again, John starts playing around with things that are going, like he did in Matt's apartment. He's picking things up. And he goes, "Hey, don't touch that. All right." And John then sees that he has a CB. He goes, "CB radio. A little low tech for you guys, isn't it? Low tech, dude. That, my friend, is an end of the world insurance system, okay? So when the last microchip goes down, I'm going to be able to stay in touch with whoever's out there. Wherever they, wh whether they be zombies or not, I'll tell you that right now." And they go, "What'd you bring your dad here for?"
Savage.
Seriously. Then he goes, "He's cool. He's into the whole gaming culture."
Sure.
And then we actually do get a shot of the asteroids machine. A pretty good shot of it. So
Yes, in the demo mode.
yes. So what can you tell me about asteroids?
As far as I know, it's one of the earliest vector-based games to play on in a video gaming system. It's got to be one of the granddaddies of them all. They're very early.
You know what year
Basically,
it was released as an arcade game?
I'm gonna guess 19. I'm gonna guess 1980 even.
You were so close. 79. Very good.
79, okay.
In North America in 70, in November 79, in Europe in later 79, and in Japan in January 80. The thing is that I haven't played Asteroids in a very long time, but I don't know if it would be as fun as it was back then because of the way that technology has advanced. It would just, I don't know.
It is difficult. I mean, it's still I've played a couple of the early games. They're available on my Tesla. I can play it on the screen in the car. And the two that came out about the same time was Asteroids and Lunar Lander.
Oh, I remember
Lunar
Lunar.
La yeah, I mean, you had to land on this little pinpoint of a flat spot on a very big hills. And inevitably, the lunar module blew up into pieces. I had a difficult time with that. And asteroids, if I remember correctly, it was made as a follow-on to space. I can't, not Space Invaders, but space,
No,
like.
it was a competition of Space Invasion.
Yeah, but there, but before that vector-based control, there was something called video space. I think it was called video space, and basically the spaceship that you control to fire at the asteroids, it was there, but it was minus the asteroids, and you were basically shooting at a single UFO that was flying back and forth across the screen. They didn't really have the brain power of to do asteroids at the time, but I think that came out around 70, 76 or 77. I think it was the first video game I ever saw after like Pong.
Oh, wow.
But very complicated. And that whole idea when you're playing asteroids and you fire the engine on the spaceship that you just kind of drift. It's frictionless and there's no gravity involved, so it just kind of floats off the right-hand side of the screen and reappears on the left-hand side of the screen, and you may be tumbling and spinning, and trying to zero out your motion is really difficult because you're always drifting just slightly, while these big rocks are floating on the screen, ready to bump into you. So I would think if you try it, it's probably a lot more difficult, despite the simplicity of the display. I think it's still a pretty difficult game.
Exactly. I mean, again, it seems very difficult. Then John walks over towards the Boba Fett poster and starts looking at it. And he goes, "Hey, nice poster." And he goes, "What? Like, you a big fan of the Fett?" And Barrel like puts his hand to his forehead and goes, "Oh God." McQueen goes, "No, I was always more of a Star Wars guy."
Oh
And he's
dear.
a Star Wars guy. Oh, he's kidding. He's kidding. Now, do you know how much this type of thing would go for now? If you wanted to go on eBay and buy a Boba Fett stand,
Boba Fett.
cardboard stand poster.
I'm gonna say, I'm gonna say $39.95.
Well, I was able to find a whole bunch of options between 45 and $60.
Oh, okay.
That's the price nowadays. But at this point, Warlock knows that something's up, and he goes, "Now, the fact that he mentioned earlier that he knows that he's being that Farrell's being chased, by that they're trying to kill him." That already says something that he really is able to follow everything that's going on here. He's very much
Yeah.
in the know, I guess you can
He's
say.
on, yeah, got he's got his finger on the pulse.
Yeah, completely. And at this point, then Warlock just turns to Farrell and goes, "Who is this man?" And he goes, "He's my." And then John interludes and goes, "Hey, dump truck, I'm not his dad. I'm a cop. How about that? Oh, a cop. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Why'd you bring a cop into my command center?" And John just starts laughing. Command center. Because it's a basement.
I'm guessing that Kevin Smith fed Bruce Willis the line about calling him dump truck. That sounds like a Kevin Smith line if ever.
Yeah, probably. Because it's a basement. It's a command center. And Farrell goes, "Don't help McClane. I can explain. Just tell us what you know about Thomas Gabriel, all right? That's why we came here. Thomas Gabriel, that's cool. I didn't know. I'm sorry. Get out. I want you out right. I want you out of here right now." "Why?" Hey, because just calm down, big boy. You calm down. This is my house. You're going to tell me what I want to know, or I'm going to beat you to death in your own house." As Marvin said in Die Hard 2, man knows how to bargain.
I think about when Holly Gennaro is in Die Hard 1 And the one terrorist comes in and just starts punching the wall, and she goes, "John's still alive," because nobody can get somebody as angry as
That's
John.
right.
And it's like, yep, that's
Only
right.
John, only John can piss someone off that much.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but again, the whole thing is the way that they set this all up is great. You know, Kevin Smith is perfectly, he really is perfectly cast in
Yeah.
this role here. And after John threatens him, you know, you see he's a little concerned. You know, they give us a great look on his face about this whole thing. Then we get a quick shot of the doors opening at Woodlawn, and we see the semi trailer entering the area. You know, we see Emerson flagging them in, letting them come in with the huge truck that will be very important later on.
Coming soon, yes.
And then we're back in Warlock's command center as he continues telling his story. And he goes, 4 years ago, the DoD recruited Thomas Gabriel to be a cyber spook for them. Okay, first day on the job, goes into his bosses and tells them that the nation's security infrastructure is wide open to compromise. And what do they say? We'll take it under advisement. But this dude doesn't ease up because he's committed, like you read about. So he breaks into the meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, okay? And using just a laptop, he hacks into NORAD and shuts down our entire defense network. So they put a gun to the man's head and forced him to stop the hack. Thomas Gabriel is the guy who shut down NORAD with a laptop, just to prove a point. You think I'm scared of you? Just tell us how to find this guy, that's all. How do I know how to find the guy? He's a ghost man. He just fell off the grid. John goes, ah, another dead end. Come on. And then Farrell goes, hold on, wait, McLean. Listen, Warlock, a couple of weeks ago I wrote. I know, dude. You wrote a mutating algorithmic. And then he gets cut off.
Yeah.
Again,
Gotta watch
he
out for those
knows.
mutating algorithms.
That's it. He knows everything that's going on here. So it's very, very interesting. You know that you can't pull any wool over the eyes of Warlock when it comes to that. So yeah, and that's the way this segment ends. Jim, did you want to mention anything else that we might have missed along the way?
I think this was a nice, this cameo by Kevin Smith is probably the smartest move in the movie. Getting him in, he comes across very natural. He gives it very realistic dialogue. For one brief moment, it turns into a Kevin Smith movie. And I think it's witty, it's clever, it's funny and clever. So and reasonable. So it doesn't You don't feel like he's acting his way through this. So I really appreciate having him show up, even if only for a few minutes of, right here.
I agree. I agree. Excellent. All right. So today's segment is Franchise Fever, where my guests will give their top five movie franchises that have at least four entries in them. So, Jim, why don't you once again start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, well, I couldn't do any of these lists of franchises without bringing up number five, the airport franchise. If you haven't experienced all the airports, even the ones without years listed after their name, especially the one without the year listed after his name, the trials and tribulations of Joe Petroni as he works his way from maintenance guy to the president of an airline in only 9 years. He did it. He managed to do that in 9 years. So I can strongly recommend Airport, the granddaddy of all disaster films. I mean, I know you could, some people want to say A Night to Remember was a disaster film, but that's more of a documentary, a stylized documentary. Airport is the ultimate in perfect Irwin Allen style disaster movies.
Yes, and there is a
So
Movies by Minute podcast about that. That wait,
funny you should
who
mention
did that
that.
one?
Yeah. I don't know, it
Who
escapes, but I'm
was
sure
the host?
if somebody, yeah, if somebody would just look up Airport Minute, I think they could find out a whole bunch of stuff about it, including two of the surviving members of the airport cast showed up, and one of the final episodes. So it's quite a surprise. But yeah, if you get a chance, Airport Minute's still out there, now 7 years old. So actually, I'm sorry, 8 years old, excuse me. It's now the eighth in its eighth year. Number four, and this I can feel that nobody else probably has this franchise in any of their lists. And I'm going to go with the Tom McLaughlin movie series Billy Jack. He had four movies, and so he counts as a he for Billy Jack, the renegade half-breed Apache and Hopi, who knows what kind of Native American he is, but he's in some kind of a unspecified tribe out west, protecting wild Mustangs from getting into cans of dog food, but making his first appearance in a movie called Born Losers in 1967. We wind up with the title, the second episode, Billy Jack, then followed by the trial of Billy Jack in 1974, and Billy Jack Goes to Washington, a very unsubtle remake of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Billy Jack, he preaches peace while kicking ass everywhere. It's if you like kung fu movies and if you like random acts of violence in the high desert of Arizona, this is the place to go. Watch. My advice is you can skip Born Losers, but watch Billy Jack first, then Trial, then go back to watch Born Losers, and finish up with Billy Jack Goes to Washington. A very I think it's neglected. It re really everybody needs a little more Billy Jack in their life just to understand how crazy independent films can be. So I'm putting it at four, but somehow in my heart of hearts it's number one.
Really? Okay.
That's where I'm at. And now I know people flip these back and forth, but I'm gonna go with three being Star Trek and two being Star Wars. And I'm sure this has been listed in everybody's groups of these are two major franchises for folks our age. Trek, if you like technobabble, and Star Wars, if you like wizards and warlocks and interrupted by space planes. They're both great. I think Star Wars, especially as we're recording this, the recent edition of the second season of Andor has really turned this into a Lord of the Rings style epic. So I'm going with three is number three is the Trek, Star Trek, number two Star Wars, and we get to number one, which is the franchise I think that has the most legs of any series. You have to go with James Bond.
I knew you were going to.
There's been so many Bonds. I've even done a Bond Minute, which if I could ever get my co-host Mark to come back, and he's kind of sworn off podcasting, so it's a little difficult. But the James Bond series, starting with TV shows in 1955 and CBS, with by the way, the co-pilot of Airport was the first Jimmy Bond before there was a James Bond. I mean, we've had so many Bonds, so many, there was concerns that the Bonds were losing their value, but really, from Barry Nelson, the very first James Bond, to Daniel Craig, and who knows at the time we're recording this, who the next Bond will be. You can't you it defines every decade that it's in. It still pulls in the crowd. People still want to see what's going to happen with 007 and how he's going to protect His Majesty's Secret Service now. So I have to have Bond as number one for the franchise with the longest legs.
Okay. Very cool. Excellent. All right. Now we will play the game State Your Motto once again.
I'm ready.
All right. So I know that you have relocated. So the state that we are going to be doing now is your new home of North Carolina. So the options are A, wisdom, justice, moderation. B, to be rather than to seem. Or C, while I breathe, I hope.
What was the first one again?
Wisdom, justice, moderation.
I don't think that's it. I think it's the third one.
Well, I breathe, I hope. No, sorry.
No, ah.
It's to be
So it's got to
rather than to
be
seem.
to be rather than to seem. Okay. Well, I just got here, so I don't.
I think you're going to be evicted. You better be careful.
Yeah.
You're like, oh,
To
Jim
be
doesn't know
rather than
that.
to seem.
Get out of here. Get out of here. If
I,
you don't know the answer to this, we don't want you here.
well, I mean, we are the home of Bull Durham, so I would think if there's no crying in baseball, that's a league of their own. Oh, well.
Bull Durham has other quotes that you could possibly use.
Wow.
Jim, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yeah, please, we're taking a summer break right at the moment. Actually, my listeners are taking a summer break. They're all waiting with bated breath for December 1 when we start the Captain America Minute, available wherever we find podcasts are available, or you can find it at our big site, which at the time we're recording this is just kind of a place marker, but you can keep checking in there for new stuff. Capminute.com.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue, yeah. But it ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one.